My title today is Justice in Judgment. It's something I've been thinking a lot about, especially with some of the circumstances that we've seen going on around us, not only in our politics, but in many other parts of the world. We see a lot of injustice, a lot of things that really we can't do anything about, and we see things all the time. And as Christians, I'm sure that we probably have a more finely tuned sense of right and wrong, of wanting to see things around us and in our nation and in our families turn out to be good and right. We want to see evil punished, and we want to see good rewarded. Even in TV shows and movies we may watch, and I was going to put some examples in here, but I don't want to tell you guys all the bad things I watch, so I'll just say that we may watch, okay? We typically like to see a good story, right? We like to see a good background of the characters in the story, and we like to see the good guys win, typically, right? We expect to see them to win, usually. In fact, if they don't win, what happens? We're shocked. Right, and I can think of some examples that have been out there recently where a main character is allowed to be killed. And you think, how could that be possible? How could the story go on without that person in it? Or how could they turn out to really be bad, to really be evil, and to really go after these people that we thought that they liked so much? Well, most of the movies, thankfully, that are out there usually end up to have a good ending. They normally, you know, have evil eventually losing at the end, and the perceived good guys normally come out on top. But as we look at the world around us, we can see many examples where that's not the case. Now, I want to take you back a little ways. I just finished reading or listening to The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, a 59-hour epic. Quite a book. But back in the 1940s in Nazi Germany, Hitler instituted something that in English it would translate to the People's Court. It was a sham of the judiciary system in Germany and was a way that Hitler could ensure that his enemies would be found guilty of any crimes they were accused of. It became a glaring example of the term kangaroo court, as the rules of laws and order were not followed at all by the Nazis. And partly this came about because Hitler was upset with the regular court system in Germany because he had engineered a plot, he had been behind a plot, to burn down the Reichstag. And they had, you know, several stool pigeons set up that were going to be taken down for this. And I think only one of the people actually got convicted, and all the other ones got away. None of them actually got any appreciable punishment. And because of that, he decided, okay, we're going to have the People's Court, and we're going to have my person at the head of that court to take care of making sure that my purposes are served. Now, after the plot to kill Hitler in July, I believe it was in July of 44, they caught quite a few of the people that did this, that were part of this. And part of it was due to the fact that many of them had diaries. Many of them were writing in their diaries all the stuff that they were doing. So as soon as the plot failed, they were able to round up all these people, look in their diaries, and find out exactly who was involved. So when they were brought into this People's Court, they were purposely dressed in shabby clothes, pants that were too big, without belts, so that the defendants were, and this is before the day when we had, you know, the people walking around with their pants down. I mean, it was a shame back then to come in with your pants down. So they were forced to come into the court with no belt and pants too big, and they were having to hold on to their pants to keep them from falling down. This is just one of the ways they were humiliated at their hearing. And technically, it really wasn't a hearing because they were not allowed to defend themselves. They were berated and screamed at by the judge and the prosecutors. And most of the people in that plot were killed, were hanged. And I think there was maybe one person, they said, that got away. And the only way he got away was that during his trial, an Allied bomb actually fell on the People's Court and killed the judge, and I think destroyed much of the evidence that was against that one guy. So anyway, Hitler used the court to basically take care of anyone who he thought was plotting against him, and of course those who were involved in trying to assassinate him. In the current events around us, we see injustice being perpetrated for various motives. In our political system, and I don't want to get too political, but we have seen instances where an individual is accused of a crime just for the purpose of getting him or her to make up testimony against another individual. Now, I had never heard of this until the recent happenings around the Russian scandal and things like that, but I guess it's not an unheard of thing that you bring in somebody who may be tangentially involved with something, you accuse them of a crime that they can't really defend themselves against, and then you say, well, we will lighten your sentence if you'll testify against so-and-so. And at that point, what's to say that that person's testimony is any better than the person trying to defending themselves? And they show little concern for the destruction and the disruption they cause to the individual or the families that are involved. We've heard the stories of people's families being destroyed by various situations because they can't, like I said, they can't really defend themselves. They don't have the finances to defend themselves. These people that do these things, they're not bothered by the miscarriage of justice, but only interested in the political gain they can get out of it. The latest issue of the Beyond Today magazine that we just got actually had a little write-up in the center about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh and some of the events that occurred around it. Now we are beginning to hear reports that at least one and perhaps two of his accusers have admitted that they lied in their accounts regarding him. They brought a false allegation against him for purely political motives. If you listen to any of the conservative pundits on the radio or TV, and I have to admit I listen to my fair share of them. My wife always gets on my case about the shows that I watch when I get home from work, but hey, you know, that's my fix for the day, is to come home and watch a little conservative, what many would think of as conservative TV. But they talk a lot about the fact that our nation is supposed to be a nation of laws, right? It's supposed to be where, you know, if you do something wrong, no matter who you are supposed to face the consequences. Yet we see that the laws of our nation, and specifically around illegal entry of citizens from other nations, seem to be ignored. They seem to be not wanting to enforce those laws. Well, the prophet Isaiah warned us about the lack of concern for the laws of God and his message to the nation of Israel. And he prophesied about some of the things that we're seeing around us right now. Let's look at a few scriptures from his writings. If we'll turn back to Isaiah chapter 5. And I'd like to read this from the Complete Jewish Bible Translation. It has a little bit better flow than the New King James. The Complete Jewish Bible Translation, Isaiah 5 and verse 20, reads this. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who change darkness into light and light into darkness, who change bitter into sweet and sweet into bitter. Drop down to verse 23. Who acquit the guilty for bribes, but deny justice to the righteous. This, it seems, is what we get on almost a daily basis from our media and political system. Political correctness abounds to the point that many are afraid to talk about their views in public for fear of retribution. In some cases, from their own employer. And you know that they've written about this, and it's true. I can tell you that it's true from personal experience that you don't want to talk about your political views at your job, especially when you know that the top brass in your company are perhaps opposed to your views. They're opposed to the way you feel. Isaiah goes on to describe further the conditions that we face in chapter 59. Isaiah 59, just jump forward to chapter 59. And again, this is from the Complete Jewish Bible translation. Isaiah 59 and verse 7. Their feet run to evil. They rush to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of wickedness. Their paths lead to havoc and ruin. The way of peace they do not know. Their goings about obey no law. They make devious paths for themselves. No one treading them will ever know peace. This is why justice is far from us, and righteousness doesn't catch up with us. We look for light, but see only darkness. For brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope for the wall like the blind. Like people without eyes, we feel our way. We stumble at noonday as if it were dusk. We are in dark places like the dead. Drop down to verse 14. Thus justice is repelled. Righteousness stands apart, at a distance. For truth stumbles in the public court, and uprightness cannot enter. Honesty is lacking. He who leaves evil becomes a target. That's the way our society sees it. If you're too good, there's a target on your back. The Lord saw it, and it displeased him that there was no justice. Isaiah was telling Israel what was in their future. This is the world we live in. Now, there are still some bright spots. We still see good being done. But as this world continues to move farther and farther away from God and continues to insist on pushing God out of every aspect of our lives, it will become more like what we read from Isaiah. And this verse from Jeremiah, I came across this verse and I wanted to include it because it so captures the spirit of our day. Jeremiah chapter 6. Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 10. Again, this is from the Complete Jewish Bible. And this is God speaking here. And he says, To whom should I speak? Whom should I warn? Who will listen to me? Their ears are dull. They can't pay attention. For them, the word of the Lord has become unattractive, an object of scorn. That's the way God's ways are in this world. An object of scorn. We have the terms today, and most of you probably have heard them, transgender, transsexual. And now, coming out of Holland, we have the word trans-age. I don't know if you've heard of this gentleman, but he decided that since he looks like he's in his 40s, he should be able to change his age from 69 to 49. Why not? You know, if you can deny reality in other parts of your life, why not deny it in your age? And he says, you know, I'll give up my pension. I'll go buy another car. And I'll get better dates, too, because I can put it on my profile that I'm 49 instead of 69. Of course, I have a feeling that reality is going to catch up with that gentleman eventually. And he's going to realize he's not 49. Of course, we understand the way this world is not what God wanted or what he intended. From the very beginning, we see that God knew a system of judgment would be necessary to ensure that justice was promoted in human society. And even the early scriptures in Genesis bring this out. Let's go back to Genesis 6, or Genesis 9, actually. This is after the flood, and God is speaking to Noah. Genesis 9 and verse 6. He says to Noah, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man." This verse shows us that as the earth was to be repopulated, that there would be a need for a judicial system to punish the crime of murder. At this point, God was mainly talking to them about killing each other. Later on, we would get more. Man was made in the image of God, so here he reminds them that they need to be able to punish murder. This would hopefully serve as a deterrent for this heinous crime. And of course, as we have heard in other sermons, as the population density of the earth grew, The necessity of more finely defined standards of conduct grew as well. We know that in the time that Abraham lived, that there existed a knowledge of God's laws that were primarily administered within the patriarchal system of the family or even within small city-states. Turn over to Genesis 18. So we know that there were laws mentioned. We don't have specific information about what they were, but we could logically think that they were probably similar to the laws that God gave to Moses. Genesis chapter 18 and verse 16. This is recounting the story of God and two angels, or Jesus Christ and two angels, coming to see Abraham to actually go down to Sodom and take a look at what was happening in Sodom. In verse 16, it says, "The men rose from there," this is after they'd eaten, "and they looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. And the Lord said, 'Shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him.'" And then Abraham realizes what's going on here, and he begins to talk to God about what he's about to do, about visiting Sodom. And in verse 25, as he begins the discussion, he says to God, "Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" Abraham calls God the judge of all the earth. In this specific instance, God had come down to take a first-hand look at Sodom before he was to pass judgment on it. Later on, when God was blessing Abraham's son, we see a reference to the fact that there were laws and commandments known. Over in Genesis 26 and verse 5, God says this to Isaac regarding Abraham. He says, "Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So during this time, before Israel became a nation, or before even Israel, you could say, was thought of, God taught and expected justice and righteousness to be done, and that there would be fair and righteous judgments made according to his laws. As his people became a nation, God set up a very structured judicial system with specific guidelines and procedures that were to be followed in the administration of justice for the nation. Let's look at a few qualifications that God gave them for judges. These were to be the men that would sit in judgments as cases were brought before them. In Exodus 18:21, we'll read to verse 26. Verse 21, "Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such as over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, to Moses, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all this people also will go to their place in peace." So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. So they judged the people at all times, the hard cases, though they still brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. God inspired Jethro as he came and he saw the spectacle. Just imagine the spectacle of perhaps lines and lines of people around the tabernacle or wherever Moses was at the time, waiting to talk to Moses. And notice he says, these people will go to their place in peace. You know, they won't be standing in line all day. They'll actually have a chance to talk to somebody. It relieved the load off of Moses. And on the other hand, off of the people. Like I said, waiting for all that time to talk to one man, and who knows how many cases were being brought. How many times do you think they just gave up and said, you know, it's not that important. I'll just forget about it. I'm not gonna wait here for hours to get in to see Moses. So they accepted perhaps injustice instead of trying to get into Moses. By doing this, justice was made available to everyone in a quick and easy manner. In a sense, the people's ability to access justice had been constrained because they had to rely just on seeing Moses. And now Moses was freed up to deal with more difficult issues and decisions. The same practice was used in Israel when they came into the land. And the instructions that God gave them in Deuteronomy, we read this in Deuteronomy 16 and verse 18. It says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribes. They shall judge the people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you." As before, justice was to be freely available to the people. And as before, the hard cases were to be brought before the Levites and or the judge or judges that was serving at the time. God's laws, judgments, and statutes were to be used as the guidebook for making decisions. And God gave them a framework of legal procedure that they were to follow. Justice was not something that was rarely seen or followed, but was to be the standard of their society. God gave them very specific standards to follow in making judgments, as well as some very specific laws and statutes. If you'd like, and I don't have time to do it here, but if you want to review some of those, chapters 21 and 20 to 23 of Exodus are a good place to go if you want to see some of the specific laws that God gave them to use when they came into the land. And we see that cases that involve capital punishment required at least two witnesses. In Deuteronomy 17 and verse 6, God told them this, Deuteronomy 17 and verse 6, "Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness." Notice when God came to Sodom, there were three of them. There were three witnesses that witnessed what was happening there, and the death penalty was given. Two chapters later in Deuteronomy, we're told that a single witness, and this is interesting, a single witness was not sufficient to bring a charge against another. Multiple witnesses were to be interviewed and their testimony compared to verify the charge. False witnesses were to be dealt with harshly. Let's look at this a couple chapters over in Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15. Deuteronomy 19:15. It says here, "One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established." So one person is not sufficient for anything. You had to have at least two people. If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days, and the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you. And those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. Can you imagine how many cases we would hear about on the news that would never be brought if this were the standard being followed? A single person could not come forward and ruin another person's life with false testimony. That would quickly stop, as it says in verse 20, "Those who remain shall hear and fear, and attempts to smear other people with false testimony would be unheard of. So the judges were to hear most of the cases in Israel, as we've read. Yet in some of the cases, they were to be brought before the Levites, or in some cases even brought before the king, the sitting king of Israel. We know that David sat in judgment. We know that Solomon sat in judgment, and even we have the example of one of his sons. I think it was Adonijah that would stand on the road going into the place where the court was and say, you know, if I was up there, I would take good care of you instead of the sentence you're gonna get from my father. But they actually brought a case. And this is a famous story. It's a case they brought before King Solomon. Let's go look at that in 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. And in our parlance, we would call this a she said, she said case. And this is, I guess, they brought this to Solomon because it was too hard for them to decide. There were no witnesses. What was the decision going to be? 1 Kings 3 and verse 16, it says, "Now two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, 'Oh my lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then it happened the third day after I had given birth that this woman also gave birth. And we were together. No one was with us in the house except the two of us in the house.'" So no other witnesses, no one else to corroborate the story. "And this woman's son died in the night, because she lay on him. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead child in my bosom. When I arose in the morning and nursed my son, there he was dead. And when I had examined him in the morning, indeed, he was not my son whom I had born. Then the other woman said, 'No, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son.' And the first woman said, 'No, but the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son.' Thus they spoke before the king. And the king said, 'This one says, you know, that's my son. This one says the other.' So he says, 'Bring me a sword.' So they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, 'Divide the living child in two and give half to one and half to the other.' Then the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion for her son. And she said, 'Oh, my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him.' But the other said, 'Let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him.' So the king answered, 'Give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him. She is his mother.' And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice." We know that King Solomon had been given great wisdom by God, and something that he asked for as a young man. And it says the whole nation, and even most of the inhabited world, and other parts of the story about him, actually acknowledged the great wisdom he had, and they came from all over the place to see him and to talk to him. As I mentioned in the beginning, this world around us is lacking in this kind of insight and the wisdom that Solomon displayed during his reign. Yet God is preparing a group of people, and I hope that it's you and I are part of that group who the scriptures tell us will reign with Jesus Christ. And we'll be given responsibility to make judgments and wise decisions in the world to come. The Apostle Paul reminded the church at Corinth of this very fact in his letter to the church. He was, in a sense, scolding them for taking disputes with fellow members outside courts. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians 6. And we just went through this in the I think it was two or three Bible studies ago in the monthly Bible study. But he writes to them and he says, "Dare any of you have any matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life?" Part of our responsibility in the world to come in God's kingdom will be judgment. Thankfully, as full members of the God's family, we will have capacity to make righteous judgments, even more so than King Solomon did, under the purview and guidance of Christ, of course. Because Christ ultimately, as it says in the Gospels, is the ultimate judge. He will be the ultimate judge of this world. There are not many scriptures that we can go to that talk about us practicing judgment, but I did find one. We're going to get there. But we are described in the book of Revelation that we will rule with Christ as kings and priests. Isaiah chapter 11 describes the administration of God's government on earth. Let's go look at that. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 3. Isaiah 11 and verse 3. His delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not, this is speaking of Christ, he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Working under Christ will be involved in doing those things. Now the prophecy that Ezekiel gave actually had some detail describing what the priest would be doing. And it's in the latter part of Ezekiel where he's describing the restoration of Israel, what they would be like in the kingdom of God. Let's go look at that real quick, Ezekiel 44. I thought I was going to be short today, but it actually looks like I'm going to use my time. Ezekiel 44 and verse 23. Ezekiel 44 and verse 23. And this speaks of the priest. And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and clean. In controversy, they shall stand as judges, and judge it according to my judgments. They shall keep my laws and my statutes in all my appointed meetings, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths. So it would appear that our role as priest will involve making judgments against the perfect standard of God's laws. Just as Moses made justice more accessible to the whole nation of Israel by following the wisdom of Jethro's advice, God will use you and me to make justice and the knowledge of God's ways freely available to a world that will desperately need it. No longer will we be bystanders, watching evil and injustices being committed around us. We will have the power and responsibility to bring justice and righteous judgments to this world. For our last verse and the conclusion of this message, let's turn back to the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. Again, another millennial verse. Isaiah 2 and verse 2 says, "Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, 'Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.'"